Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
You're listening to Noel Debien on Sunday nights.
Thanks for staying with us. And if you've just joined us, Noel Debien here just sitting in for John this week. John Cleary will be back next week. And in this hour, we're beginning with the Salvation Army's Luke Geary. It's our signpost section. And at once every 6 weeks, Luke joins us to talk about the church law, law and you, and issues that come up out of a new legal firm that's been set up in the Salvation Army. It began in Sydney last year, turning around traditional models of law. And rather than a commercial firm doing some pro bono work, this is actually a pro bono firm doing some commercial work. Luke, welcome back to the program. Good to be with you. Now, the first issue you would like to raise is the idea of compassion in sentencing. It's something that gets a lot of talk in the press and on Talkback.
Yeah, thanks, Noel. It's a pleasure to be here again. I was talking recently with a judge about coming to speak at a conference we're putting on, and the judge, very experienced jurist and was a very senior barrister, and he said that he would choose the topic sentencing in the age of compassion. And when I read it and I was preparing for this evening, I actually misread it, and I thought, is there compassion in sentencing? So it was interesting. Today the difference between the two topics, but it certainly got me thinking in a very different way than what I probably would normally approach a case. A couple of things that really came to mind were that, well, judges, of course, perhaps we don't normally anticipate this, but judges certainly are human. And what goes with that is the full range of human emotions. Mm. And that judges, much like anyone else, really want to get to know the person that they have to sentence, whether it be to send someone to jail, to give them a community service order, good behaviour bond, a fine, or to let them off. And for a judge to be able to really give the appropriate sentence, well, they have a certain set of criteria that they need to look at.
But then they also have a certain amount of, what do they call it, equity, I think, discretion.
Indeed, judicial discretion.
Yep.
Yeah. Sentencing is a really a discretionary exercise. There are a few mandatory things that judges in New South Wales, at least in terms of criminal law, have to look at. Each of the states has a different set of criteria, but are fairly similar. In New South Wales, judges have to consider and weigh the following factors. They have to ensure that the offender is adequately punished for the offence. Well, we can understand that. They have to ensure that they can prevent crime by deterring the offender and other persons from committing similar offences. They have a goal to try to protect the community from the offender and to promote the rehabilitation of the offender. To make the offender accountable for his or her actions. To denounce the conduct of the offender and to recognise the harm done to the victim of the crime and the community. And what's really interesting about those factors, Noel, is that none of them take precedence over any other.
So all those points, deterring the offender, protecting the community, rehabilitating the offender, making the offender accountable, all these things are weighed up equally, you're saying?
Well, every case is different. And there's a section of the law in New South Wales and in each respective state that says, look, there are certain things which are in a person's favour, so the mitigating circumstances, and there are certain things which go against a person, so they would be aggravating circumstances. And courts have to sentence the individual. They don't sentence that person in a vacuum. They sentence them on the basis of their subjective features.
What, can we put some flesh onto this? What's an example that would lead us through all of these things?
Sure. Look, in the work that I do with the Salvation Army, we see people who come from all sorts of backgrounds, and often people that we see and we act for in our criminal cases have come or are at a stage where they've had a period of serious drug abuse, or from a background of abuse, physical, emotional, sexual, or psychological. And those people obviously are damaged, and often that's a contributing factor to their criminal behaviour. I'll give you one example. I had a client, we'll call her Sarah. She was, in fact, my very first ever client for the Salvation Army. And when I saw her, it was back in 2005. When I saw her, she was too afraid to sit in the same room as me because I was a man. Mm. Now, she had been battered from pillar to post in a very, very abusive relationship with a man. And she came to see me back then for a particular matter, And over a couple of years, I got to know her, and I acted for her in a couple of different cases. And she started to go downhill, and she was addicted to drugs, and with that came some offending behaviour. And I acted for her, and I assisted her on a number of occasions. She started to do really well towards 2007, but then she had a bad thing that happened to her in terms of some psychological treatment that she was undertaking, and it ended up affecting her badly, and she had a relapse in terms of her drug abuse. Yeah. In 2007, towards the end of 2007, she ended up going to Redfern to score some drugs. In the course of scoring drugs, she went into a pub, and she was drug affected. The publican asked her to leave the premises, and she refused. And then the publican tried to physically remove her from the premises, but she perceived that as being a male coming to attack her because of her history of domestic violence. She had what we later discovered through psychological evidence to be what's called a fight or flight syndrome. And from that, she ran into the ladies' bathrooms. The publican, obviously doing his job, followed her in to try and remove her. As he's trying to remove her, she's inside the cubicle. He's at the other side of the cubicle trying to pull the door open and get her out, and she starts to panic. She reaches into a handbag and she grabs out the first thing she can feel, and it was a pair of craft scissors. She reaches over the bathroom cubicle and she stabs the publican in the hand. Now, obviously, this is a very serious offence. This is a person who has offended the criminal law. She has, in a very real sense, hurt a victim, a man who is doing nothing but going about his job, an innocent person of the community.
I've certainly known publicans, and they don't like drunk people on the premises. No. And unruly people on the premises, drug-affected people, and then the idea of trying to enforce safety on your premises and you get stabbed is right over the top.
He was doing nothing but his job, and this woman had come in and really thrown the whole situation out. Now, going forward in time a little bit, she's charged by the police. She goes into jail. Whilst in jail, I re-engage with her. I was able to get her into drug and alcohol treatment. She does drug treatment for a period, a substantial period of time while she's on bail.
What does that mean, substantial? Is that weeks or
months? She did a 10-month program, and then after that, as part of the treatment phase, was built in a very significant psychological treatment. So she had to undertake a very complex and a very long-term dialectical behavioural therapy program, which went for a 3-year program and a very specialised program which very few people are able to take advantage of simply because there's not enough funding for it. So she was one of the few fortunate people to be able to get into this program. And so while she's doing all these good things, the criminal case is still progressing. Now, obviously, the court has to look at those factors I mentioned before.
What she'd actually done, in fact, what she was charged with.
Precisely. Yeah. But as it turned out, we didn't end up finishing the case and getting to the point of sentencing until about 2 years down the track.
2 full years.
Yeah, the reason for that was we'd gone to a trial before a jury, and the first jury was unable to convict her. The second time we went to a trial before a jury again, and one juror had to be removed from the trial because they couldn't make a decision, and then, unfortunately for her, there was a jury, a verdict of guilty by unanimous decision. So she was found guilty, and that was at the end of 2009.
So it's taken 2 years. She'd committed a serious offence. She'd been in therapy and rehabilitation.
Yeah.
And then she was sentenced on the basis of what had happened 2 years previously.
Well, we started the sentence process at the end of 2009. And I said to the judge, and this is an offence for which there is a standard, that is, the law says, for anyone who's in the middle of the range, the standard jail term is 3 years full-time jail. So I was going into this case frightened for her because, you know, I journeyed with her along the way. And I'd seen her through the bad times, and then I'd been really proud of her throughout all the great progress she'd made over the course of the past 2 years.
So you're saying what the statutes recommend, three
yes,
years, that's
precisely
what happens.
Precisely.
And you're saying, well, that was what she was like 2 years ago, but I wish all this progress that I've seen could be taken into account.
Precisely. And so I asked the judge to make a special application. I said to the judge, look, today's the end of 2009. Give me 3 months, and we'll come back, we'll check in, and you can see how she's doing again. And we did that. I came back in 3 months. She was still doing really well. And I said to the judge, let's go another 3 months. And the judge said, all right. And so we came back again after 3 further months. Then I came back again the third 3 months. The judge was again pleased with her progress. And then I said, give me one more set of 3 months. And the judge in this instance said yes. We all came back to court again 12 months after the sentence. So towards the end of 2010, And the judge was able to have the benefit of one thing which often most courts don't, and that's hindsight. Because really now she's...
Because through the delay, and coming back to review.
Precisely. And the law allows that. And it says, for people who are in particular circumstances, the court can adjourn a sentencing proceeding to allow them to undertake a form of rehabilitation or other treatment.
So what you're saying, it's not about bleeding heart judges, because you can just hear shock jocks going off about this. You know, you're a bleeding heart judge and you're just letting your emotions get in the way. What you're saying is the law allows this to happen.
Yes.
It's permitted within the scope of law. And so you, through this process of asking for three months, actually were able to have a judge see that the improvement was real, not just something being presented after a short
period. Yeah,
precisely.
It wasn't just fancy words. It was something which this lady had... She'd gotten runs on the board, so to speak, and significant runs. So it had been, by the time the judge ended up sentencing her, it had been 3 years since the actual offence was committed. And I said to the judge at the time of this final sentencing appearance at the end of 2010, I said, "Judge, I just need to show you two things." And I had the photo of when she was arrested, and I had the photo of her, well, obviously I had her in real life then. And so the judge could see, not only on paper from the reports that we have from all the treatment providers,
but also grooming and all that sort of thing.
All the sorts of things. You could see it was a different person. And certainly there'd been no offending behaviour over that three-year period. And so in that instance, because of the flexibility of the law, the judge was able to have the tools to exercise that compassion. And in those circumstances, the judge did, and the lady remarkably got a good behaviour bond.
A bond, not 3 years in jail.
She got a good behaviour bond.
And how long was that bond?
It was a two-year bond.
That's quite serious still, though.
So for her, essentially, it's like a five-year, don't muck up, don't pass.
Or you're in jail.
Yeah, precisely. So she had not an uneasy time for a long time, but the court was really comforted by the fact that she'd done all these great things throughout that period, and it had the safety net, so to speak, that if she defaulted at any point into the future for another 2 years, then the court could bring her back and resentence her.
It's quite interesting to hear all that, especially when I read and hear so much about truth in sentencing and mandatory sentencing. Mm. Certainly judges I've spoken to really don't like mandatory sentencing because it stops them from exercising precisely the sort of process you've just spoken about. Mm. They're just compelled to give a sentence. So I think we've got time to do one more case. I think there's also a case here where concerning drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, look, I guess like I said, we do at the Salvation Army encounter people when they're at some of their most difficult stages of their lives. And the work we do at Salvos Legal, we engage with our drug and alcohol, the Salvation Army that is, its drug and alcohol recovery services. And the Bridge program is a very well respected, very detailed and very difficult program.
Well, it's a big organisation. You do law and legal advice, but there's also all sorts of other services
within
the organisation. Yeah, we've got
Employment Plus is the Salvation Army's
of course,
employment agency.
Yep.
Aged Care Plus, so aged care facilities and retirement villages, drug and alcohol recovery services, welfare services, financial management. We've got money care. So we've got all these sorts of things, and we provide crisis accommodation. So it's a very holistic approach to...
So if somebody comes to you with an issue in drug and alcohol, you can actually appeal to another part of your organisation to assist?
Entirely. And I've got a number of clients right now who are doing their program at one of the Salvation Army services. So their court cases are on hold at the moment while they undertake that 10-month program. And so that's the sort of thing that gives a judge, like I said, the benefit of hindsight, because they get to see someone not only at their worst, but they get to, if the judge has the ability to wait a while, and if that person is able to perform, they can see them get the runs on the board and change their life.
So this was the case with Sarah also?
Yes.
This is how you could refer it on. You could say, within the Salvation Army, we can provide these services.
Precisely.
The judge could therefore be assured it was really going to happen.
Precisely.
That the service was credible and it was being monitored.
Indeed. And look, that's exactly how we approach these sorts of cases. For us, it's very simple. We have the network ability to go to our drug and alcohol recovery services and say, look, I've got a client, this is the complexity of the situation, what can you do? And within literally minutes, I'll be told, yes, we've got a bed, yes, they can come in, we'll do a phone interview with them right now, and then that day I'll get a letter to give to the judge. Hmm. So there's a good, certainly a good networking ability there. But I suppose going back to the issues of sentencing, we talk often about justice, and we talk about how the courts need to be courts of justice. And I was digging around on the internet, and I actually saw something in an article which reminded me of, I suppose, some of the bitterness that many of people from the public come to us appealing for in terms of seeking assistance. And they say that they've often discovered by attending court on their own that it's not a place of justice. And a former Associate Justice of the Supreme Court in America was, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., was recognised as having said to a young man, a young lawyer who was appearing before him, "This is a court of law, young man, not a court of justice." And we often think about whether or not judges do act justly, or whether they simply apply a set of facts to the rules that they're given. It is, in terms of those sentencing criteria, what I was talking about, very much a balancing exercise. And we've talked about so far this evening about balancing those things for the defendant and the need for compassion for a defendant. But sometimes it's easy to forget, especially if you're a defendant's lawyer, it's very easy to forget who's sitting across on the other side of the table, and that is the victim.
I do remember, even must be a decade ago, having a conversation. This was in an informal situation at a dinner table with a judge, who, and this was precisely the argument: do you administer the law or do you administer justice? And there is debate on that in judicial circles, of course.
Some would say by administering the law in a particular way, I have the ability to create justice, but justice is a notion.
I think you hear Americans call about black letter lawyers. Is that what that's what we're talking
about?
Black
letter lawyers is the sort of people that apply things very strictly. They apply the rules very strictly.
And it's seen as conservative, not wanting too much equity, wanting to apply exactly what's laid down.
Yes. And sometimes what is laid down is fair, but I guess it's a question of flexibility.
Indeed. But of course, you're looking, in the sort of advocacy work you do and the legal work you do, you're looking for those areas where the law allows equity, allows discretion on the part of the judge.
Yes. And I think in all of their hearts, they certainly want to have that flexibility. I mean, otherwise, they would see themselves as relatively robotic.
Luke Geary from the Salvation Army, thank you very much for joining us again to talk about the law, the church, and you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Simon.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.